Then I was taught, A, that here and now we have spirit bodies composed of etheric material, as much matter as the flesh garment that covers them. B, that dissolution is simply the passing of the etheric out of the physical covering. C, that the afterlife is just as tangible and material as this, intense and real beyond comprehension, differing from this life in vibration only. D, that the so-called dead have bodies as real and tangible to them as ours are to us. E, that many of the dead, so-called, move about even among us, little realizing that any change has been made, unless developed spiritually. When I had learned these things, the teachers of the etheric world took up with me the character and conditions surrounding and governing life in the next sphere of development. Then I understood. Chapter 12, Man's Etheric Body. The ancients thought that ether filled the sky, and was the home of the gods. It was contended by Aristotle that it extended from the fixed stars down to the moon. Modern science has heretofore contended that all space is filled with a substance having rigidity and elasticity, with a density equal to our atmosphere at a height of about 210 miles, easily displaced by any moving mass, compared to an all-prevailing fluid or derivative of gases through which heat and light are constantly throbbing. In Modern Views on Electricity, Sir Oliver Lodge, speaking the last word concerning ether, says, "It is one continuous substance filling all space, which can vibrate as light, which, under certain unknown conditions, can be modified or analyzed into positive and negative electricity, which can constitute matter, and can transmit, by continuity and not by impact, every action and reaction of which matter is capable." This is the modern view of the ether and its functions. The most solid substance in the world is not iron, is not lead, is not gold, is not any of the things that impress our senses extremely dense. The most solid thing in existence is the very thing which for generations has been universally regarded as the lightest, the most imperceptible, the most utterly tenuous and evanescent beyond definition or computation. It is the ether. The ether is supposed to permeate everything, to be everywhere, to penetrate all objects, to extend throughout all space. The earth moves through it, the sun and all the stars have their being and their motion in and through the ether. It carries light and electricity and all forms of radiation. Nobody has ever seen it, or rendered it evident to touch or to any other sense. It escapes all efforts to feel it, to weigh it, to subject it to any kind of scientific experiment. It plays no part in mechanics. It neither adds to nor takes away from the width or substance of any known substance. We are assured by some of the highest authorities that the ether is millions of times more dense than platinum, one of the most solid metals known, surrounding us and filling what we know as space and permeating all things, is that substance termed ether. It is a subtle essence hard to define that is in the atmosphere we breathe, highly sensitive, through which the light of the sun travels in undulating waves, but just as much a substance as the very rocks and stones. There is a gross ether and there is also a refined ether. Through the medium of the grosser ether we send our ethergrams, but of the finer, more sensitive ether, we know but little. The suggestion that all life has etheric form is entirely new. Whether we are advanced enough to appreciate a proposition so beyond our experience, is a question, but a moment's reflection, and we do comprehend that all life comes from the invisible, and ultimately goes back to the invisible. The unseen then is the real, and the seen, the result of invisible causes. There is a world within a world, all contained in this wondrous universe. We see and touch only the outer garment of the etheric universe which, temporarily clothed with gross material, is working out its development. A directive intelligence has made all nature's laws, through which each inhabited planet moves and has its being, has its domain in the invisible. The invisible then becomes a legitimate field of inquiry. I am assured by those versed in the physics of the afterlife, with whom I have speech, that all life, down to the atom, and beyond, has etheric form, that every atom that makes up the mass of rock, that every molecule of earth that covers the barren stone, that every grain of sand that forms the ocean shore, that every seed, and plant, and shrub, and tree, that every drop of water that flows in creeks, falls as rain, or constitutes the lakes and seas, all have etheric form. The etheric requires for growth a covering of matter lower in vibration than itself, the same as the seed planted in the earth, and in that outer garment it increases and reaches a higher development. No life force can exist in the physical unless it has a garment suitable for that purpose. Dissociate the etheric form from the outer garment, and the individual can no longer remain an inhabitant of this sphere. Dissolution has taken place. Could we follow into the conditions beyond, we would ultimately find that every star and constellation has etheric as well as physical form, and that they are visible only because they are clothed with gross material, the same as our own planet, for all laws hold continuity throughout the universe. It is the etheric body that sees, hears, feels, smells, and tastes, evidenced by the fact that the physical body has none of the five senses when separated from the etheric. The ear, for instance, with its complicated chamber and auditory nerves, really hears through the etheric brain. Sever the nerves, destroy the tympanum, and you destroy the communication, put any of the very fine mechanism of the auditory chamber out of commission, and you either cannot hear at all, or at best very imperfectly. Every concussion causes an ever-widening circle in the atmosphere, that is, in the ether of the atmosphere, which at last reaches the auditory chamber, communicates with those fine nerves and with the brain. By that wonderful process we understand the difference between harmony and inharmony, between sweet sounds and discords. Similarly, through a disturbance set up in the ether we understand language. Horses, cattle and sheep will exist and wax fat on grass and water. Put them all together in an enclosed field in a tropical country and keep them there indefinitely, what happens? They feed on identically the same food, and multiply, the flesh covering wastes and is from day to day replaced, a complete change being ultimately brought about. Why do they not interbreed? Why does each hold individual form? It is solely because each has an invisible form, that is a form composed of matter in a very high state of vibration which holds continuity, having reached the state termed etheric, at which point the life form neither disintegrates nor enters into new combinations. Man differs from the animal only in development. At the moment of conception, he possesses an etheric body, minute and perfect beyond comprehension, and if permitted to inhabit the physical body for the usual period of time, attains a normal growth. When by heat we break down the outer garment of a lump of coal, when the physical will no longer hold the energy, the life, or the etheric form, the two are dissociated. In other words, the energy or life form escapes, to pass into some other state. The outer garment, the cinder or ash on the other hand returns from whence it came, ultimately to be taken up by another form of life, until in time it shall have been so refined that it will hold continuity because it has become etheric. And all this to demonstrate that man is a part of one stupendous whole, evolved from the etheric life in the mass, refined to the point where he holds individuality. Death, so called, is the passing out of the individual spirit or etheric body from the flesh covering. Released from that outer garment it becomes an inhabitant of a plane where all is etheric, but to the etheric sense and touch all things are just as tangible, real, and natural as when in earth life. It is utterly impossible for a human being to understand the change in which death so-called occurs unless he realizes that every individual possesses a spirit form composed of etheric atoms, just as much matter as the flesh garment that is visible and tangible. Knowing that fact, he can then understand that dissolution is simply the separation of the physical from the etheric body when the former by accident, disease, or age can no longer obey the will of the occupant. When the physical body can no longer do its part, the spirit or etheric body, by a natural law, abandons the flesh garment, and by that act ceases to be an inhabitant of the earth plane. This is all that occurs at the time of dissolution. Chapter 13, The Unknown Land. Into the frozen north, into the terrible cold, At the cost of human life, many explorers from time to time have gone on voyages of discovery, have braved the crags and climbed mountains of ice, have faced famine and desolation, until at last upon the bleak and barren plain, a man has reached the pole and stood upon the top of the earth. Not satisfied that one place upon the earth's surface should remain unknown, other explorers equally courageous have faced the storms and cold, have crossed the crevasses, have braved famine, until at last they have found the southern pole. Man has gone to the ends of the earth, has sounded the seas, mapped the wilderness, and now all lands are said to have been explored. But no. There is another land, an unknown land, tangible, material, actual, real, and more intense and beautiful than any now known. This is the next field for exploration. Into that land all the countless dead of all the ages past have gone, all the living and all those who will in the ages yet to come inhabit for a little time this physical world will go. This being a self-evident truth, what more important field of investigation can there be? Compared with it, the discovery of the poles or the opening of the dark continent is insignificant. 51. If there is a tangible and material, yet unknown land beyond the physical, inhabited by people, why has it not already been discovered? The answer is simple. Ignorance and superstition have been barriers more difficult to climb over than mountains of ice and snow, and notwithstanding the millions who have gone into that unknown land, little effort has been made to ascertain anything concerning it. An illustration may help to explain the reason for such indifference. Before language was written, and largely before the advent of the printing press, knowledge was transmitted by word of mouth, and legends and traditions were handed down from one generation to another. Some of these were incorporated in books, and on account of being in print they found acceptance as facts. Chief among them were the stories of the creation and of the conditions following dissolution, and men without thinking for themselves or acquiring proof, have blindly accepted legends and traditions in place of facts based on laws that appeal to reason. Herein lies, in part, an explanation of the indifference. When man becomes satisfied that beyond the physical there is another world, inhabited by all the countless so-called dead, where those whom he has loved and lost live and work, the purse strings will be loosened, means will be provided, the spirit of exploration will be revived, and others as brave as Columbus, as reckless as Cortez, as heroic as Livingstone, as fearless as Perry, will become pioneers in the unmapped wilderness of the unknown land. By their discoveries the world will be enriched a thousand times more than by the explorations of the ages past into the waste places of the poles. But until the public intellect is startled, until the thought of the world is aroused, a few of us unaided must work alone. In the afterlife I have father, mother, brother, and son. Others similarly situated may be satisfied with the orthodox teaching as to where they are and their condition, but I have not been, and I have labored to know something of their daily life and how and where in the vast universe they live and work. Much has been written about spirits and spirit life, of a heaven and a hell where the so-called dead exist, but it is so hazy, indefinite, and theoretical that it has not appealed to my reason or satisfied my desire for facts. Do the dead live in houses? Why not? The plane where they live being material, why should they not build homes, furnish and beautify them? All the material in the universe is not confined to the earthland. Are they clothed? Why not? Their bodies being no less visible than when in the earth life, they, having suitable material adapted to their necessities, make and clothe their nakedness, for modesty does not cease with dissolution. Do they require food? Why not? Their digestive organs were not destroyed in making the change. True, the process is in a great measure refined so that they take the essence instead of the substance, as mortals do. In dissolution, do those addicted to opiates, liquors, or tobacco, lose the desire, is another question. No, in earth life, it was not the flesh tissue that craved opiates, but the nervous system, the etheric body, and there being no change in the etheric body, the craving continues and must ultimately be overcome. The physical cannot enter the etheric kingdom of God. Are the so-called dead homeless in going into the next life? A very natural query. Some people, I am told, have lived such degenerate lives that they find nothing waiting in the great beyond. A home may have been constructed by those who have preceded them, but they may be unable to reach it for years to come. However, those in the afterlife ordinarily work and labor to create a home and make it ready for those whom they love to enter at once when the great change comes, just as preparation is made when the newborn child is expected into this world of men. I know something of the difficulty of comprehending that the invisible can possibly contain anything real and tangible. We are in the habit of thinking, generally speaking, that nothing outside the visible exists. One has never seen that substance of which life is composed. One has never seen life because such substance is beyond our vision. We ordinarily cannot see the very great or the very small, only matter where movement is between certain fixed points, and we know little of what lies above or below. With the microscope and a drop of water, it was first possible to discover minute matter. With the telescope, we have discerned millions of stars and constellations, composing the family of the universe, which move with perfect order and precision. The possibilities have not been exhausted, and all the secrets of the universe will not be discovered by the inhabitants of this plane of consciousness. All discoveries, and all progress are the result of research for knowledge, and are gained by effort. When I was first told that those in the afterlife were real people and lived in a world as tangible as this, the subject was beyond my mental grasp, for I had been taught that the world of spirit was intangible, and existed in space, with no suggestion that what we call matter existed beyond the visible, and I never could grasp its reality until I was taught that in this, our present plane of existence, we realize matter only in a certain mode of motion when it may be said to have three dimensions, length, breadth, and thickness. If others must undergo the process which I have needed, they should adopt the same method, and not attempt to grasp conditions prevailing in the afterlife until by research and deductive reasoning they have come to comprehend matter in its higher and more refined forms and in its different modes of motion. After reaching that point, they will not find it difficult to appreciate a condition beyond this crude plane in which people, once inhabitants of this world, live similar lives, with similar environment. Having cast off the slow vibrating flesh garment called the body, they find everything as material as before. I am trying to explain this subject in a simple manner, so that any mind capable of reasoning and thinking may understand. I find it even then difficult, for the proposition is entirely new in physics. When this fact is finally accepted, thinking minds will work it out in detail and present it in 1,000 provable ways of which I have not thought, and then people will wonder that the facts were never worked out before. In time, all will come to know that this, like all other natural changes, is extremely simple. Knowledge of the environment of the next plane, and of the conditions the prevailing, can only come from those who are the, and it is from such that I have obtained my information. Let those who challenge the statement that I have had speech with the inhabitants of the afterlife remember this fact, that on an average of once a week for 20 years, under scientific conditions, I have done that identical thing and have had speech with thousands of different individuals who have proved their identity. Anyone who would deny that fact should have had equal experience, in order to be qualified to speak on the subject. So far as I know, no man has ever had the opportunity or received the information as to the actual conditions prevailing in the afterlife to a greater extent than I have. It is a fact to be noted, that the information as to the conditions prevailing in the afterlife, obtained by all careful psychic researches, substantially agrees. Chapter 14. Personal identity. Personal identity has been the stumbling block of psychic investigators. In my work, on account of the darkness required, I have to depend upon the voice and the information given for proof of identity of the individual. I have had in this regard some very remarkable proofs. It is only by showing that people in the afterlife have material bodies and live under material conditions that we can appreciate how they may speak with direct voice and prove their identity. Assuming that they have bodies, that they retain the same etheric form that was clothed with the flesh garment, and that they live in a material world, we do not find the fact that they speak to us and communicate with us in various ways startling. On the contrary, it is reasonable and natural not only that they should do so, but that they should be just as anxious to communicate with us as we are to communicate with them. I recall an incident that will appeal to the purely materialistic. I was one of my father's executors, and after his dissolution and the settlement of his estate, speaking to me from there, next plane, he told me one night that I had overlooked an item that he wanted to mention to me. I replied, "Your mind was ever centered on the accumulation of money. Why take up the time that is so limited with the discussion of your estate? It has already been divided." "Yes," he answered, "I know that, but I work too hard for my money to have it lost, and there is an asset remaining that you have not discovered." "Well," I said, "if that be true, tell me about it." He answered, "Some years before I left, I loaned a small sum of money to Susan Stone, who resided in Pennsylvania, and I took from her a promissory note upon which under the laws of that state I was entitled to enter a judgment at once without suit. I was somewhat anxious about the loan, so before its maturity, I took the note and filed it with the prothonotary at Erie, Pennsylvania, and he entered judgment, which became a lien on her property. In my books of account there was no reference to that note or judgment. If you will go to the prothonotary's office in Erie, you will find the judgment on record, and I want you to collect it. There are many things that you don't know about, and this is one of them." I was much surprised at the information thus received and naturally sent for a transcript of that judgment. I found it entered October 21, 1896, and with that evidence of the indebtedness I collected from the judgment debtor $70 with interest. I question if anyone knew of that transaction besides the makers of the note, and the prothonotary at Erie. Certainly I did not know about it. I had no reason to suspect it. The psychic present at that interview could not have known all about the matter, and I certainly collected the money. My father's voice was clearly recognizable on that occasion, as it has been on hundreds of others, and I cite this instance for the benefit of those who measure everything from a monetary standpoint. Dr. Isaac J. Funk, a man of much learning, spent 40 years in psychic research. He published the result of his investigation and many of his conclusions, but he always lived in awe of the criticism of science. I spent many hours with Dr. Funk going over the details of my own work, and I discussed with him many of the problems with which we had to deal. He was much interested in the investigations that I was making with Mrs. French, and for that reason I arranged for her to go to New York, where she spent 11 days with him and his associates. There, under conditions that he desired, she demonstrated the work she was doing with me. The result he published in his Psychic Riddle. He was always anxious for proof that the voices which he heard were independent, and he wanted evidence of the identity of those with whom I had speech. These points he regarded as important to prove the continuity of life, and in his work he was unable to satisfy himself concerning them. His method was to attempt to prove a fact by the process of elimination, that is, to prove truths by demonstrating their opposite. He, like all other scientific men, attempted to rear a structure by tearing the structure down. This process has impeded the progress of nearly all psychic investigators, and I often said to him that one should seek what he wanted to find with open and receptive mind, always having in his thought that conditions cannot be changed to satisfy anyone's particular notion, that we must accept conditions as we find them and make them better, to enable us to gain the end desired. In all of Dr. Funk's published works he left a loophole in his conclusions, that he might avoid criticism should he be found in error. Some time ago the doctor left his physical body, and one night soon after, during one of the last sessions I had with Mrs. French, a man's voice spoke my name. The tone was familiar, but I could not associate the voice with anyone whom I had known in the earth life, although I knew a spirit was speaking. I replied, "Your voice is familiar, but I do not recognize it." He replied, "I am Dr. Isaac Funk. I have been out of the body but a short time, and being interested in your work, I have been permitted to come." I then said, "You may be Dr. Funk, as you claim, but we cannot permit you to consume our time unless you establish your identity. This is one of the rules that we adopted some time since, for the reason that, knowing the person, we can form some judgment as to the value of what he may say. If you are Dr. Funk and desire to continue this conversation, you must establish that fact." He quickly responded, "You are entirely right about that. What you ask is fair. I ought to be able to establish my identity." I said, "Certainly, if you are Dr. Funk, you can give us some proof of your identity. During your Earth life, you always made a great point of establishing identity." Then he inquired, "How shall it be done?" I answered, "That is not for me to suggest. You know how technical the body of scientific gentlemen to which you belong always is. If you are going to have a test here, we want it to be evidential. If you are going to prove your identity, you must do it without suggestion from me." He replied, after a pause, "Identity was what I invariably wanted satisfactorily proved. I recall a conversation I had with you in my private office at which no one was present but ourselves." "Yes," I suggested, "we had many such interviews." He then said, "I refer to one at which I asked you to make a special test at one of your meetings with Mrs. French. I asked that when someone with an independent voice was speaking, you put your hand upon the table and if Mrs. French put her mouth upon your hand, you were then to place your free hand over her head, holding it firmly, and in that situation see if you could hear the independent voice. I wanted such evidence to demonstrate that Mrs. French did not do the talking. No one knew of that conversation but ourselves, and that ought to be proof to you that I am Dr. Funk." I replied, "Yes, I do recall that conversation at the time and place. I now recognize your voice, and your proof is satisfactory." I then put my hand on the table. Mrs. French at my suggestion put her mouth upon the back of my hand. I put my free hand over the back of her head, holding it firmly, and then I said, "Is this what you asked me to do?" Dr. Funk replied, "Yes." I immediately said, "Dr. Funk, you do the talking, and we will demonstrate that your voice is independent." Afterward there was a general talk between Dr. Funk, certain of my group of co-workers upon his side of life, and me, and some plain things were said. I told Dr. Funk that because of his prominence, and as one who had investigated this important subject for many years, he could have been a great force for good, that many people in this world of men were interested in him and his writings and were guided by his conclusions, but that he never published them in full, for which reason his readers could not reach a better conclusion than he did. I told him that he had failed at the crucial moment, and had nullified the good he could have done. I added that I regarded this as a great misfortune not only to him, but to the world at large. He replied, "I realize that now more than ever. It is a fact that I was afraid of the criticism of men of science. I now regret very much that I did not fully publish my conclusions." In my own mind there was no doubt. A spirit answered and said to him, "You were the custodian of much knowledge. Through your investigations you learned many things. By reason of your position you could have done much good. That was your stumbling block, and before you can progress, you must become strong where you were weak. In my investigations, covering many years, in the room in my own home devoted to such work, thousands of men whom I have known personally have talked with me, using their own tongues. I have recognized their voices, they have recalled and related countless facts and incidents of their daily life and have proved beyond question their identity, no less convincing than in the two cases to which I have referred. Again, I have talked with many whose personal acquaintance I did not enjoy when they were in this life, but through this intercourse I have come to know them well, and admire them much. I have heard on many occasions the speech of Robert G. Ingersoll, which no man could imitate, speech as eloquent as when in his lectures he held great audiences spellbound. Henry Ward Beecher has honored me with his friendship and delivered many lectures on conditions prevailing beyond the physical. DeWitt Talmage has talked on various occasions of the duties of the ministry, and of the conditions resulting to the individual though teaching things that were unknown. He found that there was no progress possible in the afterlife for one occupying the position of spiritual leader when here, until he had searched out in his plane all those who had followed his teaching, and had brought them to the truth. Moreover, he found that he must stand and wait until the coming of those still in the earth life in order that his error should be corrected at the earliest possible moment.